I command you to heal yourself.
Up episode 26. We're back. I'm your host, David Ben. And on this episode, we talked to Sam Wagner of Shroom Squatch Mycoventures. He's a mushroom farmer, an educator, really smart and passionate dude. So I think you're going to enjoy all the stuff we talk about. We discuss another species of psychedelic mushroom. We talk about inoculating spawn with spore syringes versus liquid culture and a number of other things. So glad you're with us. If you have any questions or you want to throw some feedback our way, info@mustacheroom.com, mustacheroom.com. Our parent company, our sponsor, Mustache Brands, spelled the same way, mustachebrands.com. This is episode 26. You're going to love it.
Owner of Shroom Squatch Mycoventures, and education is kind of our primary thing. It's just me. I like to say R is like the universal we all the time. I'll try to limit that, but I am the sole owner and operator of that business. I also grow mushrooms as part of that, mostly cordyceps.
Okay.
And then some reishi, still grow that as well. I've always got some oyster, other culinaries rolling around. So I was in social work for 15 years, which is why I kind of leaned into education. And I had a really small farm with a buddy for a minute, and then we just kind of both were like, is this really what we want to do? Do we want to play the farmer's market game?
Yeah.
And just like showing up every weekend, you feel like you're hustling forever. Still feel like I'm hustling forever, but at least I'm enjoying the hustle a little bit more. And at that point, I just kind of kept having this thing that kept coming back into my head of like, you know, remembering the way that can be named is not the constant way, like it says in the Tao. And that just kept coming to me. And so I said, man, what am I really supposed to be doing with this? And that's when I moved back towards a more myco social work, if you will,
sure,
kind of what I called it, towards an education side. And I moved back towards teaching people right before Proposition 122 passed, and it became legal for people to grow psilocybin-containing mushrooms at home, of course. So even though I have my own personal feelings about that bill and about the legalization of something that has absolutely no legal weight in the grand scheme of the cosmos at all. I'll like just kind of take it and run with it at that point, because I can now teach people to do this. They don't have any fear. Just because I'm an anarchist doesn't mean that they are.
Yeah.
So they're now happy that they can operate within a legal framework. And so that led me to where I was like, cool, I can teach people to keep this decentralized. I can teach people to keep this out of the corporate capitalist hands. I mean, it'll be there anyways, but it's like at least a small group of us can remain anarchists in the middle of all of this.
Absolutely.
You probably hear me talk a lot about anarchy, because that is like kind of how I like
targeted anarchy.
Yes, absolutely. very much so. And so yeah, that was kind of how I ended up back at the education piece, was kind of trying the farm hustle. And then through that process, continuing to grow medicinal mushrooms, I'm now in the process of looking at a potential scale up with cordyceps and reishi production specifically. And then we'll put lion's mane on it too. Once we kind of figure out. We consider turkey tail. I mean, those are kind of your big four, but truth is that most people just buy wild foraged turkey tail because it's so abundant.
Really?
Yeah. And so I don't know. It's probably more resource intensive to produce large amounts of turkey tail than it is to actually forage it responsibly. So I'm sure there's foragers that's all they do that could probably speak more to that. So I'm not going to try to speak too heavily to that, but those are just the tiny little pieces I know about that. Anyway, so all that to say, like, our main purpose at Shroom Squatch is to get people to cultivate in their own home, because we believe that you learn to care for nature, then nature will care for you. And I say it all the time that all of these people who are doing all of these, you know, good people, everyone who has taken on like you know, whether they're doing ceremonies, whether they're doing therapy, whatever they're doing with mushrooms, but they have absolutely zero idea of its role in nature. You'll call it plant medicine, for crying out loud. I've heard the term botanicals used for psilocybin containing mushrooms.
I'm guilty of that too. I group together like ayahuasca and the other entheogens yeah. together with psilocybin. So I'm guilty of that as well. Yeah. I know technically it's in the fungal realm, but mm-hmm. you know, so no disrespect to fungi, but yeah, I'm guilty of that for yeah. sure.
I think it's, you know, it's one of those things that people just end up saying, right? It's like, yeah. it's common language. But I think that all of those folks who are doing all those things, they need to have some place that they're coming from where they have some understanding of nature and fungi's role in nature. And just how does this work? Like, what is it really doing? I mean, there's some theories out there that psilocybin containing mushrooms have potential to actually stabilize and maintain watersheds like in nature. And so it's like, it's not just like, we're not just eating them for their psychedelic properties.
Wait, step back for a second.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that? Because that's
I can't a whole lot because it's still a theory.
Okay.
But yeah, there are folks who are looking at psilocybin containing mushrooms for whatever reason, specifically seem to be able to stabilize watersheds that are eroding. And it has to do, of course, with the way the mycelium grows underneath the water. Probably my theory on, they don't know why, right? This works. And my, from sitting in the forest and looking at it, right, from cultivating mushrooms, why would this happen? My guess is that it would have something to do with the mycelial network being extremely rhizomorphic and holding together the soil there, at a much higher rate, but also allow the fungal organism to be able to potentially consume more nutrition because of the rhizomorphic nature of that fungi.
Rhizomorphic meaning be able to contain more water?
Rhizomorphic meaning that, you know, when you see like that ropey mycelial structure,
like that's hyphae extensions?
Okay. Yeah. So those are rhizomes, right? Just like we would talk about in plants, like a rhizomorphic organism being like an aspen tree.
Gotcha.
So those rhizomes essentially are going out further and they're obtaining nutrients through enzymatic, you know, like release. And then that is a complex organic chemistry problem that breaks down the nutrients in the soil and then it gets absorbed through the hyphae, right? So the tip releases the enzyme, breaks all the nutrients down, sucks it back in through the hyphal tube or the rhizome in this case. And we have other types of mycelial growth that aren't rhizomorphic. Right. And they're still very aggressive. Like oyster mushrooms are a good example of this. And oyster mushrooms could potentially stabilize certain watershed areas as well because of how they do all this, but it wouldn't be the same application.
Wow.
It would be more probably focused more around actual water filtration and doing things like that.
Yeah. We've talked about how mycelium has been used for packaging, like IKEA is using it for their packaging mm-hmm. and for housing structures and all kinds of other stuff. But specifically like the psilocybin being used because it has different qualities, I've never heard anything like that. So that's fascinating.
Yeah, it is fascinating. And so that's, once again, it's still theoretical. Yeah. We need somebody with lots of money. If you want to give me lots of money, go do some research. I'll do it.
Me too.
Yeah, we'll go do it right now. So that's what we need is we need people who are interested in these types of environmental projects to start using fungi in a different way. It's already being used in that way. It's just not necessarily being applied in that way, right? Like there's things that we use fungi for all the time that are remediation or regenerative agriculture, but it might not be the specific application. And therefore it doesn't receive all of the funding to create a large
not high
scale
profile
change. Right.
Gotcha.
It's also not as sexy. like, let's be real. It's way sexier to decide that you're going to hold a ceremony in the middle of your city and change people's mental health problems or just have a good time, like whatever it is. But,
sure.
You know, it's not nearly as sexy to have the realization that you're not going to save the planet, quote unquote, because that's just pure hubris. The thought that a human could save a planet that they came from is just it's insane to me.
Nice gesture though.
Yeah, it is. It's a kind gesture. We should save our species, and
right,
that
right.
We might have some control over. So anyhow, yeah,
yes,
it's cool what some of these different species can do when we start looking at structurally what's going on, you know, underground as well.
Sure. So. We've talked about the plastic eating fungi that they're looking at for helping with some of the ocean contamination, and people using mycelium based caskets so they can be merged into nature. So yeah, lots of really cool applications. I don't know about the casket thing. I'll have to look into that a little bit more, but
yeah, I've done a little bit of research. It's
it's cool that they're at least
it's cool, but
thinking outside the box, or in this case inside the box. Yeah. But
that will happen either way. That's what I'll say about it.
You're going to grow into nature one way or another.
Yeah, it will happen whether you put a mushroom mycelium shroud around you or not.
Kind of accelerating the process.
Yeah.
One thing I want to touch on real quick that you brought up while you were talking, the keeping mushrooms decriminalized as opposed to making it to the next legalization mm-hmm. stage. And we talked about that on my last episode of the podcast. Just the set and setting are so important, and the appreciation for the lineage of the mushroom, obviously, because it's not just something that you frivolously throw around and take in any context. I mean, there's a process if you want to treat it with respect and get the most out of it. So I'm with you totally on keeping it decrim, but some people are not cool with going back channels or growing it themselves. So I do like the option for them to go to a safe space where they, not necessarily a psychiatrist, but somebody that's well-versed in the mushroom space, can help them hold space, integrate, you know, all the major components. I'm okay with that being an available resource, but I'm definitely not okay with just having dispensaries now selling psilocybin mushrooms. So I'm totally on board with you. Where in the current phase with what they've passed and how certain certified professionals can administer and other things, like where are we in terms of like the ultimate legalization? Are we getting closer to that? Or are we still kind of hovering beyond decrim?
Well, if we look at what, So we look at what's going on in Oregon. Oregon's obviously
that's a disaster.
Than we are. It is a disaster.
They legalize everything, right?
Yeah, kind of. They at least decriminalized everything.
Okay.
But what they're doing, and this is Colorado somewhat following suit on this, and I didn't listen to the last meeting of the long acronym, the Medicines Advisory Board, the Natural Health Medicine Advisory Board, I believe. But what I, from my understanding, is they're starting to put those legal frameworks into place so that those can happen in 2025.
Really? That's
think that's their goal.
Okay.
One of the things that I know that they're adopting from Oregon, and this is because it's federal, is that if you're going to cultivate this to be used at one of these quote unquote healing centers, I like to say quote unquote, because I believe the healing center is the person, not a place.
True.
And so I think that there's a great amount of hubris in calling it a healing center to begin with. I've never sat down with my therapist and been like, cool, I'm in your healing center. It's like, no, I'm in an office.
Sure.
And you're going to help me figure out how to heal.
That's yeah. Healing just has like healing center has guru connotations associated with it.
Too much. So anyhow, those centers that will be using psychedelics, they'll have to be getting them from a DEA licensed cultivator. Right. So, and my understanding is from this last, and this is so sad to me, but from this last meeting, is that they will only be allowed to cultivate cubensis mushrooms, because apparently, you know, HPLC testing and all of these other ways we have to determine like potency is not enough. We should just use cubensis. And I don't know what, I think it's because they're like, we can bite off this small chunk and we can use that. I don't know. There, to me, there's got to be some ulterior motives for why you would say it could only be cubensis.
Well, you would think they'd hone in even further if they're trying to keep it an even dose, like the basics, Golden Teacher, B+,
right.
Treasure
right.
Coast, not the Tidal Wave, Penis Envy,
right.
Top of the Spectrum.
All of the heavy stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It is. You know, it is one of the most researched psilocybin mushrooms. So I do understand it from that perspective. They know most of the alkaloids that are contained in there, not all of them. There's some stuff going on that we're not aware of. But some of these other species that are much more potent or maybe quite average compared to a lot of cubensis even, there's a lot of other stuff going on that we don't know what those alkaloids are. So,
which is a good segue to something we were talking about earlier. So on this podcast, you know, my range of growing has been limited to psilocybin cubensis. And so I haven't even ventured into the other options. Like, can you tell me more about the one that like you're interested in now, or that that you're teaching about? Because we're kind of oblivious to this point.
Yeah, we were talking about the psilocybin natalensis, and so it's from Natal, South Africa. And so
that's where the natalensis. Okay.
Yeah, that Natal. So N A T A L for folks that are going to try to look that up. Insis, you know how to spell that.
There you
hopefully.
Go.
But natalensis. And it's got an interesting history from what I've read, and what I've tried to determine is that there's actually two different mushrooms that get labeled natalensis, and one is actually a cubensis, and the other one is actually a different species, and it's seven metabolomes away from cubensis, and that was done through actual genomic testing. That was determined. Alan Rockefeller did genomic testing on it along with some other folks. And usually if Alan's done the genomic testing, it's correct. So it has a different quality to its experience, and a different quality to the point where there's people who, when they eat it, they don't ever eat cubensis again.
Really?
Uh-huh. And it's very average potency most of the time, but it doesn't feel like it's average potency. It actually feels stronger in some unique ways. It is the only mushroom that I've ever left my body on, like completely left my body. And I know other people who have said the same thing.
Really?
And so there's also a stimulating ecstasy-like quality to it that cubensis often doesn't have. And there's less anxiety. I had a buddy who once called it the family-friendly mushroom because there is a lot less of that kind of anxious feeling that you can get with certain cubensis mushrooms.
Sure. So it's very benevolent.
Yes.
Nice.
Yes. I've had friends talk about meeting the mushroom god there. And I had one friend who said he met the mushroom god, and then the next time he ramped up the dose and he said that the mushroom god came back, but he brought all his friends.
Oh shit. Okay.
So
this, if I'm looking for spores online, like some of the websites I use, SporeWorks, Spore Store, I don't know that they necessarily offer the natalensis. Where would I go? I mean, do you on your website have liquid culture or spores?
I do have that liquid culture.
You do?
Yes.
Broomsquatch.com?
Yep.
Nice.
Yep. And I'll have the natalensis. Always Yoshi, Dino Spores. He's always got great spores. I'll go get stuff from him. And then there's a couple of local folks, like Full Canopy.
Okay.
Those guys are great, and they carry a really strong natalensis culture as far as it's very vigorous. It grows very well. A lot of what they do has been geared towards grow in the bag stuff. So
less monotub.
Yeah. The genetics have been really bred for high CO2, low fresh air exchange, which is one of the reasons that, you know, when people get these all in one bags and then they inoculate it with just whatever, it doesn't necessarily do that well.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons it doesn't, is because you can breed the mushroom genetics and do certain isolations. They're going to be better for high CO2, right? And so natalensis is a mushroom that actually grows very well in oyster mushroom-like conditions. So a lot of fresh air exchange, lots of oxygen, low CO2. They really love that, and it'll cause them to grow big, and the flushes will get bigger. So that's not the way that people usually cultivate cubensis, and that can make it a little bit more difficult for some folks that don't already have that kind of setup. However, you get genetics that have been bred to withstand high CO2, they'll still do quite well. And that said, like, I've had natalensis like completely take over a petri dish before, like with pinning and growing like giant mushrooms.
Oh, the agar actually starts to pin.
Oh, hard, okay. Hard. Like, I've had there's a lot of mushrooms that'll pin on acid.
But it takes a while usually for that to happen.
Yeah, but natalensis are like, they will, it's hard sometimes to get them to not pin, to like use the agar before it has pinned. And a lot of folks who've worked with it will say that, yeah, that's kind of
interesting. So they're aggressively growing.
Yes.
So
they eat very quickly. Like, I'm talking, you're usually putting them to fruit within 2 weeks of putting them.
Wow.
Like, if you put a tub together, it's 2 weeks probably before you're growing these.
Any pH variance or anything as opposed to the normal cubensis?
I always raise the pH in my substrate just because mushrooms just don't like acidity, period.
So where do you hover, like 7.5, 8?
I'll even go to 9.
You go to 9, okay.
Yeah, but yeah, eight is enough.
Okay.
I do that with, like, when I do oysters, same way. And then wood's pretty neutral, so it doesn't matter if I'm doing something on wood. But yeah, any of those, I'm always balancing my pH. I raise it with everything.
And you use hydrated lime, you said?
Okay. Yep, hydrated lime. It pretty much does the trick with everything. It's kind of caustic, so I always wear gloves. It dries your hands out, but yeah. So if people are listening, it's, we'll get some, and then don't breathe it in. Put your gloves on. Like, you can not wear gloves doing the rest of the process if you do it right without fear of contamination, but you'll regret getting.
Let's talk about that for a second. So I'm a big proponent of the still air box. I have a flow hood, you know, obviously that's the best case scenario, but I'm a big proponent of the still air box just because I want to account for spawn transfers and all the other stuff that you'd want to do in some still air environment or in front of a flow hood. But I heard that you do the just open air method with a lot of your bags, or at least Roy told me that.
Yep.
I guess what's your thoughts on, like, doing the open air inoculation method versus going over the top using a still air box or even a flow hood?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously I do all my genetics work in the lab because you can't get away with that in front of
the flow hood.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's just certain things. I mean, it's really about looking at what is the current substrate, what current state is it in? And this is one of the things I talk about in my class that I like to teach people is, like, I am more than anything, like, I want people to be successful growing mushrooms. Of course, that's why they took the class, right?
Yeah.
So they're going to do that. And I'm going to make sure that they get replacements if something fails their first time trying. I make sure that people realize they're going to fail. And I bring stuff that I'm currently failing on to say, this is what it looks like. So before you send me that text, does this look like contamination to you? We're going to make a short film called, Does This Look Like Contamination to You?
All different colors.
Oh, you know, it's crazy. And it can be beautiful.
Sure.
When you show people that, you teach them to understand, like, there's only contamination here, not contamination in the rest of the world. Like, there's places where this application is absolutely needed. Trichoderma is, like, one of the primary decomposers in nature. Like,
really?
We need it. We used to stonewash genes with Trichoderma.
Interesting.
It's everywhere. This whole thing of, like, I spray the air with Lysol and all this crap. Like, maybe if you just release Trichoderma in the air, like, scrub the air a little bit. But it's just over the top. That said, there's a lot of things I do that would seem over the top. But the truth is that your technique and your understanding of what inputs you have that you're putting together are the most important things for clean and successful cultivation. Technique is everything. And you know, it's like I said, the inputs. I've had so many people say, like, I was using 100% isopropyl alcohol, but it didn't work. Like, well, that's because 100% isopropyl is too polar. And, like, that's some science that I didn't know until I started using isopropyl.
Now, I know 70 is the sweet spot, 90 is flammable. That's all that I know.
Yeah.
So what is the 100 actually detracts from its ability to sanitize?
Yep.
Really?
Yep. It won't. It's a great solvent. So I usually have some around because you pour agar everywhere when you're pouring dishes. You
sure
mess up and you've got a mess. So you need a solvent around. Mineral spirits works fine too, of course.
Okay.
But it's what we would call polar. So it's got too much. There's just not enough water. That's how some people would describe it. There's not enough water, so it can't bind to the contaminant. It's like the ionic charges don't match, and so it repels all the contaminants, and it won't break them down.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So stick with 70.
Stick with 70 to 80.
Okay.
Anywhere in that range is good. Anything under that, and then you don't have enough isopropyl, then you're too much water.
Okay.
So, yeah, but things like that, right? That's the kind of the example of, like, this is an input that you're using, and this input is causing the problem. So if someone was like, well, I was injecting it with a spore syringe. Well, that is not a good input because those are ungerminated spores. They're technically not even alive. It's a single cell gamete. It hasn't even germinated.
So spore syringe versus liquid culture, night and day when you're talking about open air inoculation.
Absolutely. Any inoculation.
Any inoculation. Okay.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I'll get a spore syringe and I'll put it on a petri dish to start working with the genetics. That's right. Where you start, mm-hmm. right? Because that's where you can tell, is this clean? Number one. Number two, does this look good? Are the spores still viable? Like, and if they are, maybe only these are germinating well over here and the rest is real spotty and it's not doing well. So
always test on order. Definitely.
Yeah, always. And then when people, of course, don't know how to do that, then they buy the spores because they're like, well, this is legal. I can do this. I can, you know, it's legal to have. It's legal to purchase. Obviously, once they're germinated, that's a different story depending on what state you're in.
Germinating meaning starting to form mycelium outside of the culture.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And of course, that's another thing we can talk about. We'll put a pin in that one, but whether or not mycelium is actually contains psilocybin, but jury's still out. Spoiler alert. But injecting something with a spore syringe is just not going to be as effective, even if those spores are clean, because you're asking the spores to germinate in a 3D medium as opposed to a 2D flat medium. Sure, agar dish is 3D. We live in 3D, but it acts more like a 2D medium because it's a single plane that you're expecting it to germinate on. And when you put it in a bag of grain, my joke in class is always that it's like you're trying to have a kid and you decide that you could either fuck in a McDonald's play place ball pit or do it on a bed, right? One's going to be more successful and not cause diseases. So
it creates great visuals.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a Chuck E. Cheese would be willing to let you fornicate in their balls. Exactly. Yeah. Just why wouldn't they?
Just come.
It's this very family friendly activity. Cool. Okay. So my experience with contamination and bags with open air inoculation has all been with spores.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I've had like a bad taste in my mouth. I've done a lot of inoculation into jars with liquid culture, but I kind of gave up on the bags when I was having issues with the spores.
Right.
So that's good to know. The liquid culture gives you a higher rate of success.
Yeah.
And you're still like, you still want less moving particles in the air, right? Like turn off the fan and
absolutely.
Stuff to minimize, but you have a higher rate, even just in an open environment, if you use alcohol and do it quickly.
Yeah. And so what I do is, what I teach in class is essentially that we're taking a sterile item and we're maintaining its sterility by using sanitary technique from point A to point B. So as an example, and this will be really hard, I think, for some people to visualize, but imagine you have your syringe with your needle and you're going to wrap that needle in an alcohol wipe as soon as it comes out of its packaging. So now it's contained within a isopropyl alcohol wipe or a soaked paper towel, whatever, but you're containing it within the alcohol and you're keeping it pointed down so that no air is falling into the end of that needle either. Then you have another alcohol wipe and then we're going to wipe whatever injection port creation we've got for our bag, for expanding our liquid culture, for our all-in-one bag, whatever we're doing, wipe that down. And then you're going to hit it with that liquid culture syringe. And once that syringe, once that needle is inside that sterile medium that you're transferring to, whether it's liquid or grain, it's in a sterile environment again. You could leave it on the table and go do whatever, go mow your grass and come back in. I'd take a shower if you go mow the grass, because once again, we're trying to minimize things here, but it's in a sterile place. Once that needle is now crossed into there, because all that liquid inside the syringe is also sterile. So There's a lot of things that we tell people to do, I think, in not in just mycology, but you know, when it comes to working with all kinds of like things that need to be clean and sterile. Probably the healthcare system has a little bit of a better handle on this at times, because we hear horror stories from operating rooms. But the things that we do that are a little bit over the top, like we just don't always. We're not thinking critically about what we're actually looking at. We're just doing them because we're like, well, it's better the safe than sorry.
Sure.
Right.
I do that a lot with mushroom cultivation.
Yeah.
Because you've had enough contamination over the years. Like, I don't want contamination.
You don't want it. That's right. And I'll say this about contamination. And this is what I always tell everyone is that, like, outside of that, you are going to fail. You are going to get contamination. I know no one who gets 100% success rate all of the time. No one. And if they tell you that, they're lying. They are lying you. But contamination is typically, not always, because sometimes probably still, contamination is almost always a better teacher than success. Now, you don't get an end product. If your goal is to create an end product that you can turn into something for yourself or for your friends, or you have a business and you're farming oysters and you've got, you know, trichodermas and bacteria or stroma, well, we won't even get into stroma, but running everywhere, like, that's a problem. And once you figure it out, you will learn more from that than any chapter of radical mycology that you could read. And, you know, and that's, I think Peter McCoy would probably say the same thing. So
people that don't know, that's like one of the early Bibles of mushroom cultivation.
Yeah. I mean, I would say it is the Bible, like there's nothing that compares to that. I could teach an entire course on radical mycology that would be like, I mean, it'd be 12 weeks, probably, maybe longer. Yeah. I mean, you could do longer for sure, because of some of the stuff that he kind of puts forward in that book, which is a goal of Shroom Squatch, is to eventually just teach radical mycology.
It's awesome.
So we'll see. That's down the line. But so yeah, the open air stuff is, it's a good way to get people, because I think people think that with open air, all they can do is jab this one bag of this, like, all in one bag, right? They think like, well, this is easy, this is safe. You could do so much more in the open air, because you can literally take that exact same practice that you use to jab that all in one bag, and you can expand the liquid culture, and you can extract that newly expanded liquid culture, and then you can jab multiple grain bags, and then you can pasteurize a substrate instead of sterilize a substrate, and you can put together your own grow bags or grow tubs or draw logs or whatever it is you're trying to do. You can pasteurize wood chips and put garden installations. Like, people weren't farming mushrooms in front of flow hoods, like, you know,
good point,
hundreds of years ago.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, I mean, you'll hear people say it, like, we have a lot to learn from China in terms of production. And I think it's very true. And a lot of the stuff that they're doing, they don't do some of the same stuff that we do, as far as like all of these sterile inputs being like very over the top. And once again, that said, I mean, you know, I prepare everything in front of my flow hood.
If you have it available,
you just do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'm with you.
So anyhow,
that's cool. And so with the open air method, I guess, because you're, so I'm trying to think. So everything is completely contained within an alcohol swab or something until pen meets paper, until the pen meets the bag. And because you're pointing everything down to the ground, there's no chance for anything to settle in the working environment.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Cool.
And then that final substrate, of course, you have a pasteurized substrate. And
which has just been boiled to what, 170 or
yep,
something like that.
Yep. What, between 140 and 175, I believe, is
okay,
the exact number, held at least an hour. It really depends on the surface area of the substrate, exactly which medium, how much nutrition might be in it that you're doing. I mean, coco pour, like if you're doing those, or you're doing straw is a little more likely to contaminate, and that usually has to do with the surface area of the straw itself.
Okay.
And also with the pH not being balanced properly. That's where a lot of people have problems. People have problems with straw as well, because the seed will be left in the wheat straw sometimes, and the seed has a lot of nutrition, and so that can lead to contamination.
Interesting.
So getting cropped and sifted straw is a good idea.
Okay. And you, it looks like you're heavily into cordyceps. Like, cordyceps is kind of like, is that, would you say like that's one of your main focal points right now with growing mushrooms and like your own iteration of that?
Yeah, for sure. I don't know why cordyceps like got into me.
Now, who's the guy, Mycosymbiote on Instagram?
Yeah, William
Padilla.
Yeah,
I've seen him a couple times at the Telluride Mushroom Festival. He's like the guru on cordyceps and mushrooms.
Yeah, absolutely. Him and Mushroom Revival Door, Alex, about, I don't know. But anyways, those two, they started really the first cordyceps farms in America. However many years ago that was now, but yeah, maybe they're both like following what they did with cordyceps is extremely helpful. And then really looking at the breeders, what they continue to do, has been even more enlightening for what cordyceps are, what they're capable of. And so that would be folks like Ryan Paul Gates and, you know, Jeff at Appalachian Gold.
So what's the main medicinal benefit of cordyceps? Because it's in every mushroom blend, you know, anything that you have. We talked to the guy from Umbo, that's in a lot of their products. Anything that you find with medicinal mushrooms, probably going to have some cordyceps. So like, what's the big selling point of the cordyceps mushroom?
Well, so its first recorded history was actually for libido. And that was in Chinese, like at least the first found so far recorded history was from China for libido.
Okay.
And of course, once you start thinking about that, even without the actual research and science having been done yet, like, oh, this increases blood flow. And so how does it increase blood flow? Like, what's going on? So what it happens is the cordyceps causes your red blood cell to actually be able to use more oxygen. And so thus that reduces your oxidative stress. It increases your VO2 max without doing anything. So it gets used a lot by athletes, especially folks that are doing high endurance cardio.
Okay.
And also folks that are doing like high powered cardio, where it's very explosive, like what you're doing in jiu-jitsu. Like I know that like MMA, it's blown up in that whole world of
sure.
people using it.
Yeah. Umbo's founders are MMA guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Jake Plummer.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. They love it for those reasons. Then you top it off with the fact that it's also increasing your ATP production.
What is that?
So that's all your cellular growth, like, needs ATP.
Okay.
Like, if without ATP, cells all die. So it is causing, and I don't know the deep ins and outs of ATP production, but it's causing your cells to actually be able to like continue to grow, and that's going to increase your stamina. Then it agonizes your adenosine production. So adenosine is what's responsible for helping us sleep. And with adenosine, we have four receptors the first two we use typically will produce naturally off those receptors. And that's what helps us sleep. So we get that adenosine, but there's two other adenosine receptors that we don't really produce very well naturally. But cordyceps has been shown to actually agonize those last two receptors and that production. And that adenosine that comes out of those receptors is actually responsible for repairing damaged organ tissue.
No shit.
So a lot of folks have used it, and this is where Mushroom Revival's story is really cool, is he started using it to improve his immune function because he had Lyme's disease, and he had no symptom of Lyme anymore.
No shit.
Yeah. And so a lot of folks think that adenosine production is largely responsible for its immunoregulation and helping with immune deficiencies. So, I mean,
everybody's heard the Paul Stamets turkey tail story, but
yeah.
I haven't heard, completely rid himself of Lyme disease.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And so, I don't know if you'd say like rid it. I guess if you have it, you have it, but the symptoms are gone, right? Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if you've tested it yet or what. Yeah. But
that's so cool. So, I mean, hasn't been enough research, mainstream research, to really give, I'm sure, all the benefits.
No. And I mean, we need more human clinical trials with stuff like cordyceps. We've had it with turkey tail. We're getting some of it with lion's mane.
Good.
But with cordyceps, it's like we just need more human clinical trials. And there's not enough. Well, there's really no negatives that we've seen with cordyceps. There's what the imagination has done with The Last of Us, but the likelihood
great,
that
great series,
even,
but yeah,
it was
scary.
That's not going to happen. That would be like a parthenogenetic like type of existence, you know, but that's, I don't know. That seems like so very.
Yeah. I definitely don't want to give the cordyceps a black eye because of the science fiction.
Yeah, no, not at all.
And also with the story of how it grows inside of insects as a pesticide.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like that's just, it's some mind blowing stuff, but lots of positives. So
positives.
You know, don't focus on the negatives.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, those are kind of the main things. It's also antiviral. That's another one I would throw on there before we're done talking about its benefits. They've shown that cordyceps will actually kill HIV in a lab. Now, is that bioavailable or not? Once again, we need human clinical trials to determine that. It's also killed every SARS virus that we ever encountered in a lab. So, you know, once again, is it bioavailable? Not really sure.
So if people want to buy cordyceps, do you sell
yes.
variations of it on your website?
Yep.
Shroomsquatch.com, baby.
Yeah. It's a mouthful sometimes. I say it. And it's...
No, it's perfect. So that's really cool. Now, one thing that I read, and I'm sure you have your thoughts on this because you kind of alluded to it a little bit, is a lot of the mushroom companies that are selling supplements, ground capsules, things like that, they're using the mycelium more so than the fruiting bodies to produce larger quantities with a lower level of effectiveness, essentially. Yeah. Have you seen a lot of that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's huge. I don't buy supplements that don't use fruit bodies.
Okay, good.
I encourage no one to buy supplements that don't use fruit bodies. You know, there was a petition to get that to quit occurring that went out. MX Mushrooms, actually.
They wanted to use mycelium instead.
No, no. They created a petition to get companies who were using mycelial biomass to label it as such and to quit calling their products mushroom products.
It makes total sense.
Yeah. There's the number one offender and everyone knows who it is, but without naming the name, but it's going to be like Voldemort anymore. You can't even like say his name, but, it's,
I mean, we don't have any real, friends or enemies on this podcast. Yeah, so
exactly.
Yeah.
But it is a problem like that. Sure. It's snake oil is how I've always said it. You know, I'm from Appalachia, so we talk about snake oil salesmen, but
a lot of medicine man.
yeah. And that's what that is. There's nothing that they say like, well, it contains polysaccharides. Well, of course it does because it's ground up grain and grain contains polysaccharides,
which I don't know what that is.
It's the sugar that's produced essentially.
Gotcha. Okay.
That's essentially what it is. And so, yeah, in carbohydrates, they contain polysaccharides. Everything contains polysaccharides for the most part. So, like, what does it actually contain? Now the focus has really shifted towards testing and being like, well, we have the highest content of beta-glucans. Like, we got our stuff tested, and our beta-glucan content is amazing. And I'm also kind of like, okay, I could eat straight oyster mushrooms and get all the beta-glucans I could possibly want. Beta-glucans are important, yes, but all that does with testing is shows that you extracted something. But if I'm taking cordyceps, I don't care how many beta glucans are coming out of that. If I'm taking reishi, I don't care about the beta glucan content.
That's a bonus if you get it.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. It's become this like litmus test for like, our extractions do something. But anyone who's worked with like any extractions would tell you, and I have, I'm not an extraction person, but people who've done the testing, because I've talked to people who actually, the guys at Altitude Consulting, for example, you could do the exact same extraction method on something and be testing for, you know, a different thing. But it destroys one thing while keeping the other thing intact because of the extraction methods varying. So that becomes a problem because it's like, well, if we're not even sure like how to test for all these ganoderma acids that come out of ganoderma mushrooms, then who's to say that extracting beta-glucans is really a good thing?
Gotcha.
Because we don't even know how to test for the ganoderic acid, so we don't know whether you extracted it or not. Like, they're still coming up with testing methods for that. So
kind of on the honor system, but people need to say fruiting bodies.
Yes.
They don't even hover on the
mycelium. Need to start there. Yeah, for sure, on the fruiting bodies. And then, you know, like, I know people who do honest, good extractions, and you know, those are the companies that, because I know them or because I've, you know, just researched them heavily, like, those are the folks that I'm going to go to. And then, of course, I also go to people who buy their stuff from the U.S. Like, I don't, like, they either produce it themselves or they're buying stuff from the U.S. Like, I'm tired of looking at supplement companies that are still sourcing everything from China just because it's as cheap as they can. And they're like, well, you know, we can't compete, like, if we're buying domestically. And it's like, look, there are mushroom farmers like myself who will lower our price to get you to bring the economy back into America and decentralize the way that we do this. And not popular to talk about because people don't want to hear that. They want to say other things like, well, we need trade with China. And it's like, when some stuff we do, I mean, this is obviously a much larger conversation, but like, when it comes to working with mushrooms, it's like, if there's a mushroom farmer that wants to work with you in the States or anywhere in North America, even for that matter, work with them. Yeah. You know,
that's the whole farm to table concept. Like, if I get the building supplies for my recipe from the farm down the road, we're helping keep the community going, right?
Yeah.
And so with all the initiatives and everything we're trying to do with mushrooms, holistically, like this just plays into that hand. So yeah. I'm totally with you. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Electronics, you're always going to have to go overseas. Like we don't have the capacity, but if we do have the capacity to grow mushrooms, the volume, definitely. I'm with you. Domestic all day long.
Yeah. I think food production in general, right? Like farming production in general, I think that we need to figure out how to come back to our local economies. I mean, local for sure. Like, I mean, it's like almost like a fancy thing to talk about anymore, you know, but it's actually the oldest thing we ever did, you know. It was like, grew some herbs and some potatoes and, you know, some vegetables and some mushrooms in our backyard. Like that's the oldest thing we've ever done. It's so hard to convince people sometimes that like, that's all, we just need more people who are willing to do that. We'll never be able to like have organic farming on an like a industrial level. Like it's impossible. All the soil scientists and farmers that I know that I've talked to about this, they're like, yeah, it's totally impossible.
Gotcha.
They all pretty much agree. But it's not impossible for local communities and people to like be growing their own, and then also to be buying from those folks. So
yeah, I agree, man. And what you're doing with, and again, we do a lot of the same stuff here on this podcast, what you're doing with teaching people how to do their own stuff. So no matter what the legalization, decriminalization realm yields, like you still have the tools to continue your therapy, continue your, you know, recreational use, whatever you want to do, you have the tools to do it. So, I mean, it's a sustained teach a man to fish approach, and it's fantastic. I mean, there's always going to be the people that don't want to put forth any effort and still want the rewards. And, you know, maybe legalization will lend itself to them at some point. But the people that really want the most value out of mushrooms, they're willing to go that extra mile. So you're giving them all the tools. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the number one goal, is to get people to who are able to do it themselves. And the part is like, yeah, that guy over here, he might be like, I don't have the time to do that. I just need to like purchase the mushrooms. I don't have time to do it. But you know, you might have a friend who's like, well, I do have the time to do it. And then that guy over there is a tree trimmer. And he's like, well, I don't have time to get to my trees, you know, because I have six kids, but I can grow, you know, some mushrooms in my backyard or whatever. So I think that that's kind of the other thing, is like getting people to have these conversations about where do you overlap, so that you still don't have to, like you're saying, like go to a mushroom dispensary, like heaven forbid.
That's just, to me, that's opening Pandora's box of irresponsibility.
Absolutely.
I mean, we appreciate it as medicine, fungal medicine.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's at the slippery slope to just open up the door like that.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be scary. I think that would be very scary.
Not quite Last of Us scary, but
yeah.
But yeah, scary in its own sense.
Well, too many, you know, what was it Ram Dass said? He's like, "What, you can lose your ego all you want, but you still have to remember your social security number." You know, and like, you know, like losing your ego is great, but if you do it too much, you become a pile of mush. And so on some level, like, ego is self-preservation, you know. You don't have to listen to it, like when it comes to a lot of stuff, but it will keep you from jumping when the time
you have to be aware of who you are. Like, an ego has to exist. It's just a strong ego. People refer to it as no ego, but it's, you have to have some strong sense of self.
Yeah.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
I want to wind this down, dude, but so Sam, I want to make sure that people listening, shroomsquatch.com, what classes or what events do you have upcoming? I'm going to try to get this out. It's April 11th. I'm going to try to get this out by the weekend. So people can still, like, if you have any upcoming courses, they can register. What do you have on the docket?
So the next course is actually April 20th, which I realize I'm competing with a lot of things in Colorado.
Very special day.
I know, for a lot of folks. But if you come to the class, it's from 2 to 5. You still have plenty of time to go get high afterwards. So it's 2 to 5 at the Corner Boxing Gym in Boulder. I've worked with the Corner like for most of my classes. The coach and owner there is a dear close to my heart friend of mine. My wife used to box there, and that's how we got involved with them.
Nice.
So she's just absolutely wonderful. Gives so much back to her community as well. So leads me to my second course that I'm teaching is going to be May 18th, and that's cordyceps specific. That's also 2 to 5 at the Corner. And that is a fundraiser for the Corner Boxing Club. along with their Unite to Fight event, which is on June 1st at the Boulder Theater. And so that event every year is all, it's a nonprofit event. So it's all just a fundraiser for the different organizations that the fighters are representing.
I love
they choose an organization and then they raise money for it. So
that's awesome.
Where all that money goes. And so, and the corner is a, they're actually a nonprofit. So she has programs for, she has a youth program to get youth into boxing. And then she also has a program for folks with Parkinson's to continue to work on it.
So good people. Yeah, we do. Awesome. We always, we'd love to give money back to the Environmental Learning for Kids Foundation, Volunteers of Colorado.
Oh, hell yeah.
We're a 1% for the planet member. So we really appreciate anybody that gives back, especially something like that that can bring the community together over sports.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really cool. So those are the next two.
Cool.
And
people can, if they need to buy mushroom cultivating supplies, liquid culture, shroomsquatch.com.
Shroomsquatch.com. It's, the website is in need of a massive overhaul right now. So there's some things that are probably not on there. If you have an interest in finding something, please shoot me an email. Part of that's just inventory and waiting on some stuff that I've just done to get up on the website. We just finished recording an online course.
Nice.
So we're trying to get all that edited. A buddy that he has a Hail Denver Productions, and he does a cool web series called Hail Denver, where he goes around and films singer-songwriters in their home. And so he produced all this. It's like 3 hours of content that should be up before long.
That's awesome. Well, Sam, I'm so glad you had a chance to come by and talk. And we'll have to do this again, man. I really enjoyed it. You have so much knowledge and passion for what you're doing. It's inspiring, dude.
Cool. Well, thank you so much. I love the podcast.
Right.
I only listened to a little bit so far, but it's great.
Thanks, man. And so, for the listeners, just to want to plug mustachebrands.com. They're our sponsor, our parent company, Mustash Brands, Mustache Room, Mustashroom website, social media, all that stuff. Thank you so much for being here. And that's it.